Thank you everyone for attending this morning. I'd like to start by acknowledging my co-author for this study, who really did much of the work, much of the field work for this when he was an undergraduate student at UW-River Falls, and he is now a master's student at the University of Hawaii. So I'm going to be taking us to a different part of the world. We're going to be coming back to a much more humid, much wetter region and talking broad scale about the long-term impacts of agriculture on especially soil organic carbon in Wisconsin. One of the great fortunes that I had when I started my position at the University of Wisconsin-River Falls is that I landed my hands on a copy of this book, which is The Geology of Wisconsin by Thomas Chamberlain. It's a very well-known volume, and in it, what he's probably most famous for is the beautiful maps that he created. This is a map looking at the native vegetation of Wisconsin. It was produced in 1882. It's one of the first field-documented native vegetation maps for Wisconsin. He also did some work and actually produced the first soil map for Wisconsin as well. And we can already start to see the association and the correlation between native vegetation and soil types. So pretty remarkable that we had this data back in the late 1800s. But as you can imagine, for most of this country, we've seen dramatic changes in land cover over the last 100 to 150 years. Specifically in Wisconsin, right at the time that Chamberlain was producing his native vegetation map, we were seeing rapid increases in conversion of land to agricultural production. And now today, our current land cover is very different from the map that Chamberlain originally produced. We are now approximately 50% of our land is agricultural land. We still have, and that's the area in brown, I apologize if the legend is not visible. The areas shaded in green are forested land, and we've all but lost our native prairies in the state effectively to 0%. So there's been a variety of studies that have been published over the last 20 to 30 years looking at the impact of land conversion on soil properties and soil processes. And it's been well documented in the literature that as we convert land from native vegetation to agricultural production, this is a historical image of plowing up the prairie in west central Wisconsin, we see dramatic declines in organic matter and specifically carbon, with a significant amount of that carbon being lost by oxidation and leaving the system as carbon dioxide, or secondly, by erosion of the topsoil. We have a number of long-term studies that have documented this. I don't want to go into it in a lot of depth, but clearly the Morrill plots have been around for a long period of time, and they probably have most famously documented that decline in organic carbon that we see. For their particular plots, approximately a 40% reduction. And there's been a number of long-term studies. One of the things that we do not have in Wisconsin is any sort of long-term tillage plots or long-term data sets that document any declines that we've had in our state. So in terms of land conversion, the impacts can be numerous. Impacts can include impacts to physical properties, thicknesses and distribution of horizons, density, aggregate stability, hydrologic properties, but also biogeochemical properties and processes, the amount of carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, so on in the soil. So the objective of our project was to quantify the impact of land conversion in Pierce County, Wisconsin. I'll talk about why Pierce County, from native vegetation to agricultural production, on three major aspects: the soil physical properties, specifically A horizon thickness and bulk density, the soil organic carbon, but also soil physical properties, and I'm not going to be presenting any information on that, things like aggregate stability and hydraulic conductivity. So I'll be focusing on the first two. So why Wisconsin? Wisconsin is a pretty unique state in terms of its diversity of native vegetation. We have areas, especially in the south, that were predominantly prairie, and areas in the north that are predominantly deciduous and coniferous forests, and then regions in the midsection of the state that are sort of mixed in vegetation. On top of that, we have a very diverse geologic history to our state, specifically a glacial history. The areas that are shaded in the darker blue are recently glaciated areas. The areas in the lighter blue are older glaciations, things that maybe were 800,000 years ago or longer. And then we have regions in the state that were not glaciated. why Pierce County in particular, that's going to be the focal point for our study. Pierce County is sort of a nice microcosm to look at all of the diversity that we have in Wisconsin. In Pierce County, which is in the very western part of Wisconsin, we have areas of the county that were prairie, deciduous vegetation, and a mixed deciduous and coniferous vegetation. So we have a nice diversity. We also have a diverse glacial history. It represents the whole diversity that we have within the state. I realize this graphic doesn't do a great job illustrating it, but we have areas in the northwest part of the county that were young glaciations, areas in the county that were older glaciations, and then on top of that, the diagram doesn't capture this at all, but we have glacial deposits from a variety, from two different ice source regions in Canada, producing soils that are either sandy or soils that are predominantly rich in clays. So we have a really nice diversity of soil properties and soil forming factors. In terms of land cover change in Pierce County, it's representative of Wisconsin as a whole. A little bit more extreme, we're approximately now 62% of our land is now in agricultural production. So methods, we divided up the county into geomorphic regions to assess soil carbon and the soil physical properties within these different areas. We divided up the county based on the geology, the soil texture that was reflective of the ice source region for the glacial material, and then the native vegetation, whether or not it was tall grass prairie or deciduous or mixed forest. So we started by dividing the county up. After we did that, we selected the dominant well-drained or moderately well-drained soil series within each region and selected five different paired sites where we could look at an undisturbed area that had not been in cultivation and an area that had been cultivated over time. So the great challenge of this study was trying to find undisturbed tracts of land where we could look at soil conditions prior to agricultural production. And if we go back and look at the 1939 aerial imagery, which is the earliest imagery that we have for this county, you can already see that there is not very much that remains in terms of undisturbed tracts of land. Fast forward, 1992 aerial imagery, not actually a lot has changed. Most of the agricultural development happened in the later part of the 1800s. In order to do a broad study where we were trying to evaluate the influence of geology, the influence of native vegetation, we needed to be able to find these undisturbed tracts of land in a variety of areas across the county, and the best source of undisturbed tracts of land ended up being vegetated fence rows, which I realize are not highly pristine areas, but really represent the only remaining tracts of land that had not undergone agricultural production. So here I've got a very narrow swath of a vegetated fence row highlighted. That same vegetated fence row persisted in the 1992 aerial imagery, confirming that more than likely that area had not undergone any sort of disturbance or activity for that period of time. This is what it looks like on the ground. The undisturbed area was selected in that vegetated fence row area. Again, it predominantly serves as a property boundary between two different landowners. And then we looked at a disturbed area that was in row crop agricultural production with a total distance separating those two sampling points at 20 meters. So we're not looking at a very large distance in between our undisturbed area and our disturbed area. Predominantly, these areas were either in, the undisturbed areas were either in mature trees or permanent grasses. In terms of our methodology, we collected soil cores down to 1 meter. Within those soil cores, we collected at four different intervals, a 0 to 10 centimeter, 10 to 40, 40 to 70, and a 70 to 100 centimeter interval. Back in the laboratory, we did analysis of density using the clod method. We crushed our samples for carbon analysis, and then all the carbon was performed via combustion analysis. So I'll quickly cover our results, A horizon thickness, bulk density, and organic carbon. All of the data was analyzed using SAS with a significance value that we established at P equals 0.05. There was no significant effect of glacial history, ice source region, or soil texture on our results. However, there was a significant effect for native vegetation or soil order, so we'll be looking at that. Visually, this is what it looked like. Visually, you can see some fairly dramatic differences. U means undisturbed, D means disturbed. And the yellow line, or the orange line, indicates the thickness of our A horizon. This is for one of our prairie sites, and you can see a dramatic decline in the A horizon thickness. Another one, this is again another prairie site. You can see the A horizon decline dramatically as a result of disturbance. So A horizon thickness, again, the only significant difference that we saw was with native vegetation, so our prairie soils versus our deciduous forest soils. Prairie soils had a higher A horizon, or a greater A horizon thickness to begin with, and it was significantly reduced with agricultural disturbance, approximately a 65% reduction in the A horizon thickness. For bulk density, there was not a significant difference between our soils, our mollisols or our alfisols, our prairie or our forested soils. However, with the disturbance, there was a significant increase in bulk density. In terms of total carbon, which was the main focus of this study, total carbon significantly declined for both our prairie soils and our forested soils. Originally, we were trying to understand if this loss would be different between the two different vegetative types, and it was roughly the same, about a 47% loss overall between the prairie soils and the forested soils. We also took a look at carbon concentration by depth and saw some interesting results. This figure, or right now you're looking at the data for the undisturbed site. When we plot up the disturbed site, we don't see a huge impact in the surface layer, a 35% reduction, but where we do see the largest impact is actually in the layers that are below, approximately a 50% reduction in every one of our sampling intervals below our surface layer. And we attribute that to differences in rooting root concentration and the amount of below ground organic matter. So in our native prairie or even a native forest, we have a significant amount of below ground biomass, which we don't maintain in our agricultural area. So how significant was the carbon loss? It was quite significant. It's comparable to other studies that have been published in the literature. About 75,000 pounds per acre for this particular county. Our future work, we're going to be trying to pursue whether or not the carbon loss is by oxidation and loss via carbon dioxide or erosion. One of the significant attributes of these soils is that we have a change in parent material. Most of our soils contain loess on top of another glacial material, predominantly glacial till. And our hope is that we can understand whether or not the carbon has been lost from these soils by oxidation versus erosion by looking at the position of that parent material change. If it's oxidation loss, our soil, the transition between the two parent materials should occur at approximately the same depth. However, if the loss is by erosion, we would expect that we would see the thickness of that loss, especially on the surface, would be different. If it's erosion, we would start to lose some of that loess parent material, so the interface between the loess and the glacial till would actually be closer to the surface. So I unfortunately don't have that data right now, but that's what we're hoping that we're going to be able to answer this next year. So with that, I'll thank you for coming to listen to the presentation today, and I know we maybe have just 1 minute for questions. Sure.
When are you going to do aggregation, are you going to do below, for the depth below, to see if the aggregate has been in contribution of the roots to the aggregation?
Yes, when we look at aggregate stability, we will be looking at it by depth layer, depth. By okay. depth interval, correct.
So it's interesting.
Yes, it should be very interesting data.
Thank you very much.